So the, of course, I also want to thank the organizers, Antoine, Gabi, Sergey, for inviting me here and for giving me the opportunity to give this talk. And I was asked for a few specific things which I should focus on a little bit, like an introduction into the whole thing for some part of the talk, some applications which was specifically actually mentioned twice. Once it was by Antoine, and the second time it was by Gabi, that I should point out where the methodology could predict something and what we actually succeeded in predicting. So on that group, you will see what's on that record. So let me start with the following. So we assume a Hamiltonian of, say, electrons and ions, but that's not the only thing. It can be almost any other interaction which you can think of, which can be expressed as a potential, okay? If you have a more complicated object like projectors or stuff, it could be more complicated, but any other usual interactions can be n. It's a continuous space, so we have three-dimensional problem. And one way how this can be done is to use a projection approach. So you start from some trial wave function which has specified spatial and spin symmetry, and you apply this exponentiated Hamiltonian with the real parameter t. Okay, it looks very similar to usual quantum mechanical expression for a time development, but the time is not the usual time, it's the rotated time into the imaginary axis, therefore it is a real parameter. Okay. Now, since this is real, if you expand these in eigenstates, you will see that all the eigenstates will be exponentially suppressed, and in the infinite limit of the real parameter, you will project out the ground state of a given symmetry. Okay. Now, one can reformulate it into a differential form or integral form, and you will get something like an imaginary time Schrödinger equation. Okay. Once it is in the integral form, it has a suggestive shape of an evolution equation. You plug something here in time t, and you get something in time t plus tau. Well, this is, of course, the matrix element of the Hamiltonian. This is very suggestive, and of course, because we are in a many-dimensional space, the usual numerical methods to do this are completely hopeless. By many-dimensional, I mean 3n, where n can be 10, 100, 1,000, or as much as you can go. But simply, it's none of the conventional methods will do. So the only reasonable thing to think of is actually to use stochastic type of a methodology, which is immune to the dimensionality problem under some mild assumptions. Okay, so how to do this? So you say we will assume that the value of the wave function will be given by a density of some sampling points in three-dimensional space. Okay, so our wave function is actually given by a binning of delta functions in the three-dimensional space, and this delta function we'll call colloquially Walkers. Of course, there is some statistical error, but that will not bother us. So we have the, we have the equivalence of system of sampling points or walkers. You can look at them as eigenstates of the position operator, and you can say this is actually a special type of a basis. That's essentially what you can say. Now, obviously, we don't know it completely because this binning procedure takes away lots of properties of that function, for example, like continuous derivatives or something. But nevertheless, it gives us enough of information to evaluate expectation values, namely the things which we actually want. Okay? Now, how this is solved? Well, you find an approximation for this Green's function here. For small tau, there are ways how to do that. So you by Trotter expansion here and iterate. Simply, you plug in something, you propagate, getting this time, plugging back until you reach the long time limit. Now, formally, this is perfectly exact. No matter what symmetry you put in there, it should all work. Of course, this formality doesn't tell you about the efficiency of that process, okay? And it is deeply inefficient, or deeply, I mean, exponentially inefficient if you do it in the most naive way, okay? The reason is the wave function for many fermions will be both positive and negative. We assume the Hamiltonian to be time reversal invariant, so it can be chosen real. Therefore, it will have pluses and minuses. If you do, you know, something for pluses, something for minuses, the Schrödinger equation is linear. Therefore, plus part will converge to the bosonic state, minus part also to the bosonic state. That difference will be disappearing exponentially fast in projection time. Okay, that's in a nutshell the fermion sign problem. So how to deal with the fermion sign problem? Consider the following product. This is our solution. This is the trial wave function. Multiply them together. You can modify the Schrödinger equation accordingly. This will be slightly changed, but fundamentally it remains exactly the same for this product as it is for just the wave function. Once you have this product, you can think about the so-called fixed node approximation in the following way. What is the fixed node first? Well, what is the node first? The fermion node is the following. If you say your wave function, or if you basically write the wave function equal to be zero, this is an implicit equation for a 3n minus 1 dimensional hypersurface, which is called fermion node. Okay. Now the fixed node approximation is following. We'll simply enforce that this product f, which is the solution times the wave function, will be always larger or equal to zero at the nodal surface. Namely, two functions will be forced to share the same subset of zeros everywhere. It means that then the nodal domains will be the same for both wave functions, therefore their product will be always positive inside the nodal domains. Now, this is a big leap of faith, because the anti-symmetry, which is a highly non-local condition, namely I have two electrons here, I exchange them, that's a huge jump in the configuration space, and the function one is, in one case it is positive, in the other case it has to be exactly negative, so it's a highly non-local, we replace it by something like a cool boundary, which is local, which is very nice actually, as far as the simulation is concerned. Obviously, we have a fundamental point that the accuracy is determined by the quality of the nodes of the trial function. And this is, of course, basically the only approximation in the whole approach. And we'll spend 80% of the talk on various aspects of this fundamental point. And as a byproduct, I would call it, if you know where the exact node is, you are able to recover the exact energy in almost always in a polynomial time. There are cases where you could create even the bosonic problem to be exponentially demanding, but typically we know how to do the bosonic thing. Fundamentally, we are doing a bosonization of the problem, okay? You put the boundaries inside the wave function is positive, therefore you have a special bosonic problem inside the given boundaries. Okay, that's the reason why it can be very efficient to solve. Now, for many of you which never did these types of calculations, I thought it might be useful to go through the basic steps. What do you do when you actually do a real material calculation with this methodology? So first of all, typically we take only valence electrons. So they are replaced by the pseudo potentials or effective core potentials, as quantum chemists call it. Obviously, you want to check this step in order to be sure that your Hamiltonian has enough accuracy in order to be useful in a more accurate calculation later. And there is a whole plethora of testing procedure what you can do. We will assume, and I hope that you will believe me, we always make sure that this approximation is valid for the quantities, which will be interesting. Electron-electron interactions are explicitly involved, so essentially that's from the origin of formulation. Size is up to a few hundred valence electrons, typically now can be done. Not saying that it's easy, but basically it can be done. Now the simplest form of the trial wave function is of the Slater-Jastrow type. So you have spin-up, spin-down determinants here, and a correlation which basically makes the whole process much more efficient. Correlation increases the efficiency by about an order of magnitude or more. Note that the not all business is solely determined by the anti-symmetric part, which is the determinant in this case. This can be more sophisticated, and if I get time, I will try to mention all of these things as we go. Yes?
What do you do with things like semi-core states?
Semi-core states are usually included in the valence space. So on iron, the semi-core is in the valence.
And if you want to do F-electron materials?
Well, you include as many subshells as you need to. So, I don't know.
In other words, there's a whole literature about all electron methods in band theory versus pseudo-potential methods. And how do you know that you're not going to use something very expensive on a Hamiltonian, which is not so good? I mean, how do you test?
Well, I mean, you can always test the Hamiltonians within the mean fields. Right? I mean, you want to reproduce all electron versus pseudo potentials within the given methodology. And you go that deep until you understand it. Actually, we made a lot of...
So you have pseudo potentials for QMC?
Well, this is a long question. And as soon as we fall into the pseudo potential hole, we'll not get out of it for the next half an hour. But anyway, I'll be glad to explain every single detail what we do. Okay? So if you believe me now, let's move on, and we'll talk about it deeper if we want to. So orbitals which come in here are coming from a variety of methods, and I'll be actually mentioning a lot of examples of various types: Hartree-Fock, DFT, hyper-DFT, possibly CI or beyond. Okay. For solids, since you are really calculating always a finite sample, you have supercells and finite size corrections associated with the whole thing. Again, a significant amount of technology where many QMC people actually contributed, including Dave and others.
So in your method, your U coolant is also from this density function theory, or?
What?
U, right?
U has nothing to do with the density functional theory. I forgot to say. So this is a function which depends on inter-electronic distances, distances between the electrons and ions several simultaneously, and other types of any quick to calculate quantities which you can put in. It means you put explicitly electron-electron cusp there, and other higher-order correlations if you want to. There is always a the trade-off, how quickly you can calculate and how far you go into, say, cluster expansion in two-particle, three-particle, and so on. Okay, so this is, yes?
So it looks like your trial wave function is a product of later determinants.
That's right.
But the real... many body wave functions should be...
As I said, we'll be continuing along the path on improving to BCS, Fafian's backflow, and so on, okay? So, and I'll put it here later.
But that's the one that fixes you enough, right?
That's I mentioned that this piece is completely positive, therefore everything as far as the nodal surface is a concern is here. And everything what later will concern will be here and here and beyond. Okay, so we'll be actually talking about it a lot. So, now fixed nodes in reality, okay? I mean, everybody gets scared at this point because this is a very complex multi-D object. So here, just an example, this is a piece of a solid wave function. So this green isosurface is a 3D subset of 59-dimensional node. It's obvious that you can't do too much by hand with that object or something like that. It's all defined indirectly. So in some sense, it seems that it's very difficult to parameterize this efficiently. Okay, you can't do that directly. You can never see the whole thing. You always do it indirectly by guaranteeing that your mathematical object is anti-symmetric and so on. Nevertheless, it is systematically improvable, at least for small systems. For small systems, you actually can go very, very far. As far as the simulations are concerned, it's easy to enforce. You basically evaluate the sign of an anti-symmetric form, for example, a determinant. And at this point, I mean, we could talk about this some more, but I would like to do it like David did 30 years ago. Let's try and see what this will bring you. And I have a bunch of projects which I would like to show. This one is very old, and I already forgot about this until I talked last week to Wei Tao Yang, one of the DFT developers. Yes?
I still don't understand. So if you have, so single slab determinant fixes you the knot. So
that's right.
So, but if I just have a simple example of a D-shell with several D-electrons, where the ground state is a mixture of center determinants, so obviously you cannot describe the knots of that mixture.
By a single, yes. So you put more determinants. I mean, we do that on a very standard basis. Yes.
I see. So you can fix your knots with a mixture of determinants.
Absolutely. I mean, single determinant or multi determinants. That's almost the same as far as we are concerned. Yes. So you will use expansions. We'll talk about that in detail, even with more sophisticated forms. Let me finish this project. Basically, in the middle of 90s, I got a call from a quantum chemist. Krishan Raghavachari. He was a well-known pro in this business. He's a co-author of Gaussian and things. And he asked me, what are we working on and how big systems are we doing and whether we can do C20. And I asked, why in particular C20? And he said, well, we have a puzzle. It was in the time when C60 was big and people were looking what is the smallest fullerene which you can make. And the smallest looked like this dodecahedron C20 because it had the same symmetry actually as C60, at least formally in the in the geometry. But of course chemists came up with other ideas, and two other competitive isomers was slightly curved graphene or almost graphene, so this is a pentagon with hexagons around, or this dimerized ring. And why I'm mentioning this, because the puzzle was as follows. So if you took just plain LDA, the cage, which is very compact, was the lowest, then was the ball, and the ring was the highest. If you change into some of these DFTs, for example, at that time, Baker-Liang power function was used a lot, you got the opposite. The lowest was the ring, and then was this ball, and the highest was the cage. Now, Hartree Fock was somewhere in there too, and now you have the whole zoo of DFTs which would go, they would continuously cover all the possibilities between these two, okay? Well, we did the calculation. We had no clue whether we are right or not, but we had the courage to say we are right, and the lowest one is actually the ball. Then a number of people recalculated this over the years. I've seen about 5 or 6 methods to do so. They all finally said, yeah, we agree that the ball is the lowest. Here, this thing depends on geometries and stuff. But the funny point is, they still use this example to tune the functionals. That was exactly what Wei Tao did. Not tune, but verify the quality of the functionals which they developed. Let's put it this way. They verify the quality of the functionals which they developed. So they verified, and I was talking to Wei Tao last week. He told me, we reproduce, your ball is the lowest. Anyway, so this was one of the small predictions. So there was no big splash. It was only small prediction, but it was very cool and it's still used. Another example of an interesting system, which was done by my collaborators actually in Bratislava, in Slovakia, the group of Ivan Štych, is the azobenzene molecule. This is from another corner, which is an optically active molecule. Basically, if you this is the ground state, if you shine on it with the light, it will just flip like this. Okay, this thing goes. And it's pretty dramatic. It's the whole benzene thing does this spatially. So it's a pretty interesting system, and the chemists were very much interested in all the details of excited states and barrier and things. So this is a busy graph, but basically the two important points are the blue star is the experiment, and this diamond, red diamond is the QMC calculation. So for all the states here, we got better than 0.05 agreement with the experiment, except this thing where it was 0.25 electron volt. Now you can say 0.25 electron volt is not a big deal, but for chemists 0.25 electron volt is 5 kilocal per mole, and it's very significant. So it was this excitation for one of those isomers. Basically, we recalculated a number of times, and we started to claim that the experiment is not okay. Now, to answer to your question, what do you need to do to get this type of accuracy, 0.05 for the excitation? Well, you need multi-determinantal wave functions. And this is exactly what we employed here. So you take restricted CI, take out the coefficients, reoptimize the coefficients, and if you do it right, you get this type of accuracy that it basically sits on experiment, or you can actually start to question the experiments. These are, of course, small things, I mean, in a big picture, but anyway, it's very difficult to get those, and from coupled cluster, you run out of the steam on this size of a molecule. It's basically not possible to get them.
It doesn't let you to reoptimize it.
It does let you. I mean, I'm not mentioning a lot of technology which is below this because it would be boring for the whole talk, but it enables you to reoptimize that too. Okay? You can put it into variational version and basically do that.
So the hybrid functional does a very good job there, right?
Pretty good. But maybe not that perfect as if you start to go to higher excitations, which I didn't show yet.
So it's still there.
Pardon?
B3
leap S.
Oh,
I think it's actually usual B3 leap.
Maybe spin orbit?
Mm-hmm. No, there is a spin orbit is tiny here. This S, I thought maybe it was tuned. It looked like on a zero state. Anyway, this is what we're able to get. Let me show you another project.
Yes. You didn't tell us the end of the story, so is the experiment actually incorrect?
We don't know. The point is that the experiment is actually, the signal for that excitation is very, very tiny. They need to use model calculation to extract the signal, and we started to question the whole procedure.
It's been redone and it was better.
No. We basically discovered that maybe, guys, you don't have right this one particular thing. So anyway, it's a nice thing to try to get involved with. This. So another project which is also interesting is just the simplest semiconductor example, okay? Silicon solid. This is fixed no diffusion Monte Carlo, single determinant PBE functional orbitals. Nothing else, just this thing. And here I have atom and a solid energy per atom, okay? So here you have only 3s and 3p states in the valence space. We can calculate this is the fixed node DMC with one determinant. And here we can recalculate in Aptilian methods, this is only four electron problems. So you either do it by brute force in CI, or you take input wave function in QMC and confirm that it's the same number. The difference is 0.03 electron volt on a total energy of course, with four electrons, you say, okay, so what? Then you put it in the solid and then do up to 214 atoms to get rid of the finite size effects, and you end up with something which is almost the same error. How we know that this is the error? Okay, so here we need help from experiments. So we take exact atom plus experimental cohesion energy. Okay. And, I mean, we say that this is the best estimation of the total energy which we have in the system. So if you try to calculate the cohesion, okay, if I do just fixed no diffusion Monte Carlo, namely take these two blue lines and subtract from each other, I get some cancellation of errors because they both of them have small error in here, and I get this amount of the cohesion. It compares very favorable with the experiment, but if I do the fundamental point that I calculate these four electrons exactly, subtract that number, I get the upper bound, I mean the lower bound on the cohesion, because the cohesion is a difference, so what is upper bound becomes lower bound. So we claim the cohesion is this number or larger. And if you look at the experiment, it is not that much larger. So this is, in some sense, we are like nailing down the systematic errors in a smaller and smaller corner. Okay?
Is that supposed to be 6.5A, or you say it's 2 eV, the rigorous slow down?
Oh, this should be 4, I'm sorry. Yeah, of course. Okay, you caught the typo. That's good. Okay. Now, this was a very recent project, which was much larger scale than the previous ones. And this is what comes into the category of strongly correlated systems, or at least sufficiently complicated system, transition metal oxide. And we are interested in these both because of fundamental reasons, like the usual difficulties for transition metal oxide, and also because this was relevant for high pressure physics, like Earth interior, the iron oxide is one of the parent material at certain regions of the mantle. It was also interesting because the standard DFT approaches actually are a little bit worse here than usually. The structure comes, actually the equilibrium structure is this, which is basically rock salt structure, B1 cold and anti-ferromagnetic 2, namely the orientation is along 111 planes. This guy is actually a tetragonal distortion of the same thing, and essentially not too much really changes, except that it's a little bit more squished. And if you do the standard DFT, GGA calculation, this guy comes a little bit lower than this guy. So it points towards a higher pressure structure because it's a little bit more dense, and therefore it's the biasing direction of the DFT. So it actually pushes towards this guy. Now, if you force it to be in this, and do the DFT, you get a metal, which is a well-known feature of these types of systems and these types of methods. Now, how the pressure actually works, and this is a little bit so that you get a feeling what's happening in the system. So if you take now something like a Hubbard U, you can actually start to get into a much more reasonable picture, namely you get an equilibrium structure to be equilibrium, high pressure to be high pressure. Instead of Hubbard U, I actually like more mixing of an exchange. As far as the total energies are concerned, their behavior is similar definitely in this system. So if you actually mix into the PB at 10% of the exact exchange, the pressure becomes positive, you get the right ordering. If you crank it up to 20%, the pressure becomes larger, and coming close to more realistic values of what they actually observe in experiment. Now you say, okay, so you just need to tune this thing and you'll be fine. Of course, if you go into, say, manganese oxide, which shows similar feature, well, the percentage here will not be the right percentage there, and therefore you need to do something about this. And so let me first show you how the fixed or diffusion Monte Carlo compares for equilibrium parameters. So this is the difference between the energies of those two structures. Here it is, you see there's a negative here, we get it positive. The other structure is not usually observed at equilibrium conditions, so basically it's larger than zero but with unknown value. Now the cohesion comes very, very close to experiment. I wouldn't say that our accuracy is really that phenomenal, but it is actually a ballpark. We get it within 0.2 electron volt for the cohesion. And this is a very difficult number actually to come up out of the thin air. Okay, it's very difficult to come up with a method which can do this easily. Equilibrium constant, you see there is a tendency to squish by the DFT. Here we get the lattice constant roughly right. The bulk modulus is very reasonable as well. You can calculate the gap also, and it is reasonable, or not perfect. You can or should ask, how do you calculate the gap? Because you have just the wave function, and I should say how you do that. So imagine that you have a supercell. The supercell dictates you that you occupy a bunch of K points in your brilliant zone. Now, let's take the highest occupied states in the valence band and move it into the conduction band, okay? And build the wave function for this particular state. So what did we accomplish? Well, we took ground state and we took excited state. This is, I still claim that this is what nature basically does. It can be the same or not. It's actually not crucial. it is not crucial. There are caveats, but it is not crucial.
Depends if the gap is direct or indirect.
Direct or indirect. But you could say, you could even, artificial, you could do any scan which you want. It doesn't matter. You say, okay, this is a phonon-assisted excitation. Why not?
Anyway, you are comparing to the optical gap.
Here, there is the optical gap. So that's well defined, basically. And so, in some sense, what you calculate is exactly what nature does. Okay, nature has no idea about your one-particle eigenvalues or quasi-particle eigenvalues, I claim. It knows only total energy. You hit with another quantum of energy, it goes into another total energy state. And this is what we are trying to compare. So, of course, it's a very crude single, difference of two single states. But anyway, you can calculate basically the edge of your gap in this way. Okay, now once you can calculate total energies, of course you can calculate EV curves, and here they are, and try to do a tangent construction, or you calculate the enthalpy, and then you reconstruct the PV diagram. And these are the calculations, the lines are from calculations, and the dots and squares are from experiment. So you see that the equilibrium stuff lies essentially on the line, and here we are a little bit off, which is not, fundamentally surprising. We have a very idealized system, FEO. In reality, FEO is never perfectly stoichiometric FEO. There's always a little bit less of our oxygen because there's too many electrons coming from iron. So it actually likes to be a little bit off the stoichiometry, which stabilizes significantly the lower phase. And the pressure which we came up was about 65 GPa, while the experiments see anything between 70 and 100, depending on experiment which you look at it. The consensus is building that it's on the higher side here, but nevertheless, as I said, this is a model system, so we basically believe this is a lower bound where the transition pressure can be. As far as considering what we did, I believe this was interesting. Now, comes an interesting point in here, which I want to explain. What were the orbitals in this calculation? Actually, the orbitals from this were from PBE0 functional, and we took the weight of the exact exchange as a variational, in some sense, as a variational parameter. Namely, we basically calculate, this is the weight of the exact exchange in the functional. So we put, say, small weight, and we calculated the energy changed, and we calculated the energy until we got this curve. Now, this is the different volume, the equilibrium pressure, and you see that the minimum in both cases is very close to 20%. And you might recall that empirical, yes.
So I usually just take not hybrid by PVE or LDA orbitals. Would the result change? Because it looks like you're playing with those orbitals.
No. That is exactly what I'm not doing. So the pure DFT stuff will be here, okay? So what I'm trying to do is...
I say that if you just take the orbitals from LDA, would the curve change?
It will go higher because they are less optimal. So this is exactly what we are trying to do. We are variationally optimizing a DFT function. Namely, we are trying to optimize not only the wave function, but also the effective Hamiltonian which generates you the orbitals. And because it is a variational procedure, you can optimize anything what you want. Everything is just a big optimization space. So, what does the Hartree-Fock weight do in this case? Well, many of you definitely know this. In Hartree-Fock picture, you get kind of an ionic thing where lots of electrons are sitting basically on oxygen. If you put DFT, it gets more covalent character, and this is actually a very critical parameter where the optimal point is. So, I claim here there is a byproduct besides just you know, the results in here. So what we did, actually, variationally optimized the fixed node energy. Orbitals are better than artifog. They are kind of correlated because most of the correlation in QMC is captured. So you get all the bosonic correlations and cusps and all that stuff. And, I mean, this idea is not new. David used it in different contexts before. They optimize not only the wave function, but you can optimize also effective Hamiltonians. And it need not to be necessarily a single particle Hamiltonian. An arbitrary number of parameters is fine as soon as you are able to optimize.
But your parameter space in this case is just peak and different functionals.
Yes. So it's very, very simple, which is, of course, great because that's
simple. Would you be able to calculate the density and then try to reconstruct the best consumption potential, which reproduces that density and make this self-consistent?
Possibly, yes, although it would be a very costly procedure because density is a function in three-dimensional space, and you would have to squeeze the error bars everywhere to a sufficiently small value in order to be able to do inversion of the whole thing, which would be a little lot.
That's for hydrogen.
Yeah, for
solid hydrogen.
And you can compare how, say, LDA potential.
Well, it corresponds to finding the trail function that has the maximum overlap
right. With
the exact wave function. Rather than finding a trail function that has the lowest energy, you try to find the wave function that has the largest overlap. And this corresponds to getting the densities to do the same. So it's a good procedure, but as it says, it's more difficult.
In this case, not for hydrogen, for this stuff, it will be a lot of, two orders of magnitude increase right away. So, but nevertheless, this was interesting. Imagine that you have a two-particle, or you know, you have a Hamiltonian with a certain number of things which you are not sure about. This is a variational procedure to nail it down to the lowest possible. If you assume that the fixed node energy is a sensible variational quantity. Okay, now why I'm mentioning this, so there is another point. Imagine that we optimized that functional and found roughly that the optimal value was around 20% of the mixing. So now we, of course, took the whole thing back, recalculated the density of states. This is PB0, density of states. And now look at the 20%. The gap is coming out, not perfect, but reasonable, okay? It's not very reasonable here, and it's not very reasonable here, but here it is reasonable. So we optimized ground state, and we looked on the spectrum, and at least the edge looks reasonable. I wouldn't say that this fine structure is anything great, but then nevertheless, the edge looks reasonable. So it tells you at least that the mean field Hamiltonian makes sense, okay? If you optimize the ground state, even the excitations are coming out sensibly.
Yes.
No, but it's the DFT. It's the density of states of the Hamiltonian you've optimized.
Right. I mean, with the fixed value of the weight of artifog. Yes. So it's a very simple-minded, basically, just to look back, you know, what that Hamiltonian then gives you. Because we optimize for the ground state, not for the excitation.
I understand.
There's how does the moment compare?
I haven't calculated that. It should be easy. I mean, I didn't think that was that such a great thing. Only it was interesting that even the excitation edge, I mean, always looked into it.
So let me make sure I understand the procedure. I mean, basically, you have a big optimization procedure that has to do not only with your prior wave function, but also with the effective Hamiltonian that you use to generate your orbitals.
Right.
So you do this solar optimization, and at the end of the day, so QMC gives you this.
Right. You have a minimum.
At the end of the day, you look at the density of states of that optimized Hamiltonian.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So. Now, I guess that it might be interesting for you to see what was the methodology behind this, what were the technological details. So as Gabi asked, yes, semi-core states are in the valence space, so 3s and 3p is there. I mean, the orbitals we have seen, size was up to 16 FeO units in the supercell, up to, say, 350 electrons. I'm not talking about finite size corrections, how we found it. This was the Slater Jastrow wave function. This is descaling in this regime. This I'm not mentioning. Now, look here, 1 point on that EV curve was roughly 30,000 hours. Now, you can say this is a lot. Now, you could say this is a little. It depends on your perspective. I claim that this is a little because this is only one night of 3,000 processors. So, and I mean, Ron Cohen had a good perspective on this. He said, well, 20 years ago, DFT was a supercomputer problem. Okay, now you can do it on your laptop. So in 20 years, you can be doing this on your super laptop. So anyway.
Or maybe
it is, pardon?
Sooner, I would
say. Or maybe sooner, yes. So it is roughly 3 orders of magnitude slower than any DFT type of a calculation. Now, what do you get for this, I mean, once you invest this time? So, typically, the amount of the correlation energy, namely the difference, say, between the single determinant, the Hartree-Fock or DFT or whatever, minus the exact energy, is in this range of percentage. We, of course, never know exactly what that is. We just know roughly where it is.
I have a question here.
Yes.
Your previous transparency really showed that the hybrid functionals that the chemists like with 20% exchange, they're extremely accurate. So what happens if I now I try to compare your Monte Carlo with the hybrid?
You mean as far as recovering this?
How much?
I think it will be completely off. Those functionals are not variational objects.
So you think that the hybrid energy is really...
The differences are meaningful. The total energy is complete crap. So... So... Want to make a small recapitulation so that we can go into the deeper things. So... This is, I hope that I demonstrated this. This is typically what is observed, although it's not perfectly guaranteed. What was interesting on this case, and there is some physical information in the whole thing. Note that I took what you call a strongly correlated system, anti-ferromagnet. I took broken symmetry solution, namely unrestricted Hartree-Fock, spin up the spin down wave, you know, polarized. And it was only single determinant, and still the results look very interesting. I mean, they are not perfect, but they look very interesting. This is actually coming to a very fundamental point, which we actually observed over the last 20 years on a variety of the systems. So I already showed a bunch of calculations from various corners. What is coming out consistently as we do this is the following. 90 to 95% of the correlations are bosonic-like, okay? That's the stuff which happens within the nodal domains, okay? Only this, what is missing in here, is the fermion substance, essentially what we are missing. So even if you are doing, you know, no matter which theory, you should always think about this. 90 to 95% is bosonic-like. That happens in a positive part or negative part of the wave function where there is no sign of the fermionicity, so to speak. And, I mean, the fixed mode approximation is the only key issue for 5 to 10% of the correlation. So it gives you enough accuracy most of the time for getting, you know, the robust quantities, as I call them. Cohesion, gaps, large excitations, anything what is of a fraction of an electron volt or larger. If you start to go, though, into a small, tiny things, you know, magnetic orders or something finer, 5 or 10% can still be significant. So that's the place where we start to lose the resolution. We simply, at this point, we don't know exactly where you happen to be if you want to, say, compare two magnetic phases, because, you know, difference between magnetic phases is of the order of Neil temperature. It's 250 Kelvin, which is below. So simply the resolution is still not there. So what to do with this if we want to improve the resolution? Well, the other day I said to one of my colleagues, you know, this is a direct method. You take the Schrödinger equation and you directly solve it. And if you want to improve the direct method, you have to provide direct information. So this is an attempt actually to understand something about this approximation. So as I said, this is the zero locus of the wave function. It divides the space into domains with the constant wave function sign. There were interesting things, actually, some time ago, Hilbert Courant and other people did some work, but we need much, much more. So there are essentially a few points which we would like to understand. First one is the nodal topologies of the cells. How many nodal cells are actually there? Because if you don't do this really right, you will be probably missing something on energy, and you might actually even do a wrong sampling if you are unfortunate enough. Now, how the shapes, you know, how you can work to improve the shapes, how complicated are they, and then these two things maybe we'll touch colloquially as we go. Okay, so a little bit of, for those of you which don't know, what is the topology of those nodal cells? So in 1D, actually, that's a nice example because we know that exactly. Okay, if you put 1D fermions on a line, you know that each time two fermions cross each other, the system goes into a new nodal domain. Since there are n factorial orderings of fermions on a line, you have n factorial domains. The thing dramatically changes when you go into the higher dimensions, 2, 3, and so on. In 3 dimensions, we know few special cases of exact nodes for these two atomic states. One is a two-electron atomic state, triplet S of the helium atom. This node is given by this difference of the radii, and one could show it very quickly because the wave function for S state depends only radius 1, radius 2, and R1, 2. If you exchange the two, R1, 2 doesn't change, so you have only this condition. You immediately see that there are only two nodal domains, okay? R1 is greater than R2 or vice versa. Later on, we found actually these three electron atomic states, which was kind of funny because with three electrons, that's already a complicated many-body problem. But we wanted to fix all these symmetries that it has to be quartet, asymmetry, and odd parity. You'll find out that it has to occupy these guys. So that's the state, and the node is exactly given by this. In both cases, the symmetry is so constraining that no matter what is the interaction, this will be the exact node. So in this case, you know, and you immediately see again there are two nodal domains. These three vectors are either left-oriented or right-oriented. And basically, that's plus or minus. The node is, of course, at the point when they are linearly dependent. Now, David already in 92 was thinking about this, and he basically formulated the conjecture that for dimension larger than 1, the ground state of the fermionic system, which is not degenerate, the ground state is unique, have only two nodal cells, okay? And he gave a numerical proof up to 200 non-interacting fermions in 2 and 3D. And for that, he used an interesting construction. So first one requires to realize that actually if you're tilling by permutations, you will cover the whole configuration space. Namely, if you have a point inside the nodal cell, okay? Now you apply all possible permutations, you have to cover the whole space of your system. Now, for a given wave function, okay, you now want to find a point which has the following properties. Imagine that this is the configuration space. We pull out the many-body point. So these are positions of our electrons in here. And then you actually want to do the following. Imagine that you want to exchange these three guys. Since this is a triple exchange, it can be written as a product of two double exchanges. Namely, it need not necessarily to change the sign. And now if you are able to do this without hitting the node, they are, so to speak, positively connected, and you draw a triangle. Now, you connect by the triangles all the possible triple exchanges which you can do. And if you end up with a cluster which is continuous, okay, then you claim that there are only two nodal domains. Why? Because the connected cluster of triple exchanges exhausts all even or odd permutations. And if you apply tilling, there is essentially no space left. There's an interesting point. Actually, exactly the same thing happens in the, you might remember, the 15 puzzle from the elementary school, okay? 15 puzzle is basically a square with the small squares with the numbers. And you have one square empty, and you can slide these squares in the puzzle. And you are supposed to get this nice ordering with the empty square on the lower right end. Mathematicians quickly realize actually that if you do just really these types of sliding, essentially you have these triples, cycles, permutations, and you can exhaust or even permutations through those, but nothing else, okay? So if you do this, you can always end up with this. Of course, if you cheat and physically replace two of them like this, you will never get in here, because then you are moving only in the space of odd permutations, and you can end up only in this state, which is in some sense antipodal to this one. Okay, you have a square here and you start from here. So this is in some sense the simplest the demonstration of the nodal domain configuration for 15 fermions. Actually, it's completely perfect. You can show this to anybody. I needed this picture for the talk, and nowhere on the web I could find exactly this configuration. So I took the, there was a Java applet in there and slided it until I got in here. So, okay. Now, you can ask, is this really how the fermionic ground states behave? And the answer is yes, this is exactly how the fermionic ground states behave. So if you take just a very simple system of spin-polarized closed shell ground state, which is given by a Slater determinant, which is a special form, namely that the components are monomials of the particle positions, up to a certain degree in the polynomial, which is given by the closing the shell, or you can do homeomorphic map which doesn't change any topological properties, then the wave function is actually only two nodal cells. So I claim this is deeper than physics. This is just a property of anti-symmetric polynomials. And this covers a lot of paradigmatic models, harmonic fermions, homogeneous gas, fermions on a sphere, and so on. It can be actually extended also to inhomogeneous polynomials. It requires more work, but one could show, which is kind of interesting, is that Hartree-Fock atoms have the same property, although Hartree-Fock is not an explicit solution. It's a numerical solution, which is very complicated after all. But it still keeps the same structure as the non-interacting case. I'll skip this, because that's a little bit too much of proving here. But let's focus on the following. Now let's occupy both spin channels. So if we have non-interacting case, you end up with a product of spin-up and spin-down determinants. If this has two nodal cells and this has two nodal cells, product will have four. So it goes up, the nodal counts can increase if you put more symmetries into the system and you require special types of symmetries in there. Now, you can say, this can be shown explicitly, but I use just the physicist proof, okay? You have four nodal cells for a singlet, they are all equivalent, right? This thing is only just the permutation of the particles. So they are in some sense degenerate, okay? Now what happens when you switch on just general interaction? Well, the degeneracy goes away, and in fact you see a topology change, and multiple nodal cells will fuse into the minimal two. So in some sense, and this looks like a completely general property for the fermionic states, So in some sense, you see a very beautiful picture coming out of this, okay? All the bosonic ground states are sort of global S-waves, and we knew that. That was known a long time ago. But all the fermionic states are sort of global electron, say, P-waves. I mean, there is no axis of any angular momentum, but you have only bisection of the configuration space, very much like they've conjectured many years ago. So it's pretty much a fundamental property of this system. Let me skip this, and let me give you just a simple example of what the interactions would do to your system, where you can see it actually very much with naked eyes. So we have three electrons in a Coulomb potential in the lowest quartet, so all the spins are up, and we have asymmetry and even parity state. In non-interacting Hamiltonian, you have these two states, okay? They will be degenerate because the same occupation of the subshells. So they have the same energy. Now you switch on the interaction of almost any type, for example, Hartree Fock. That's enough to pull this guy down, and this will be ground, and this will be excited. If you look on the Hartree Fock node of this state, it's actually this with just six domains. So you ask, how is this possible? Well, it's possible because of the following reason. It's a total, you know, the overall S state, but also each of these orbital is S orbital. Therefore, there are so many restrictions on the symmetry that you get a quasi one-dimensional system because each of them depends only on the radius. So you get quasi one-dimensional property, namely three fermions, three factorial is six, so it's a quasi 1D system. Now look what happens when we switch on the interactions. So this is the case. So we have actually a plot where we look along the right axis. So we see these six domains. How many? Three, nine dimensions, eight, five other dimensions are essentially like orthogonal to this one. They are irrelevant, okay? So you see the whole thing actually only on this subset. And now you switch on the interaction, which and so you correlate the wave function either by putting more determinants or Pfaffian. And what you see is the following. You connect these pluses and you connect these minuses, and six total cells collapse into two, okay? So you see is explicitly on, and this is the simplest system in which I could come about. Now I mentioned the Pfaffians. This is towards the direction how the nodal surfaces can be improved. So basically we're trying to build more intelligent wave functions. So one was the expansion in the determinants. The second one is the Pfaffian. And the Pfaffian is a mathematical object which is a signed sum of all distinct partitions of permutations, okay? So in some sense this reminds you the determinant except one condition, that there is this inequality between the indices. That gives you only all the irreducible pair partitions, unlike the determinant which just takes all the permutations irregardless. So in some sense it's a little bit more intelligent object than determinant, and it has also a physicist definition. If you take a pair orbital where here have both spin and spatial degrees of freedom, and if you apply anti-symmetry, namely you take a product for two n particles, you anti-symmetrize, you end up exactly with the Pfaffian. So you see that this will be an anti-symmetric matrix then. Okay? Now, every determinant can be written as a Pfaffian, vice versa, it's not possible. So Pfaffian is actually more general, it's more clever construction. And what is actually very important for practical calculation is that the algebra is similar to determinants. You can expand in Pfaffian minors, you can do elementary changes of the matrix. And in some sense, Hartree Fock is a special case of Pfaffian. And now one can kind of divide the spin and spatial degrees of freedom into this expansion. And now by choice of these pairing channels, we suggested the following wave function. So you have a pairing in a triplet channel, up, up, single channel. You can put unpaired if you want to or if you need to. So this will be column of unpaired particles. You have also triplet down, down. You put the whole thing in, anti-symmetrized, and you get a Pfaffian. Why this is nice, we believe that it's nice, because it enables you to treat all the spin states consistently, because you have pairing in all pair possible pair channels, and you can have unpaired as well if you want to. So this can be expanded into, you know, one particle orbitals and so on. Note that the BCS wave function, well, BCS wave function is not really in the canonical formulation, not really a wave function, because it's in grand canonical ensemble. But if you project on the finite number of particles, then the BCS looks like this. It's a determinant of spin up and down. Imagine that you start to now flip the spins until you get into the fully spin polarized case, you end up with the Hartree-Fock determinant in here. So you are losing the correlation as you are flipping the spins. In this case, this is not the case, because you correlate also in a triplet channel. So all the spin states can be described consistently. In results for the atoms here, and small molecules. So these are all the calculations which we did with Hartree-Fock nodes, Pfaffian nodes, and these are brute force expansions into determinants. So you see that the Hartree-Fock kind of varies depending on how much of a near degeneracy you have in these cases. And in these cases, almost none, so it looks good. So if you take the Pfaffian, you see that it's much more consistent. Consistently, you are getting more percentage, and the variation between various cases is much smaller. In this case, you see the contribution of the triplet pairing, which is very tiny. These are the BCS nodes only, and this is with the Pfaffian with triplet pairing. It's always very little, actually. It was surprising to see that. So obviously, the triplet pairings are, say, two orders of magnitude smaller than in the singlet case. Okay. One can expand in Pfaffians exactly like in determinants, and you gain something on the compactness of the wave function. Three Pfaffians compare favorably with 98 determinants, 5 with 85, 11 with 136. So that's part of the appeal of the whole thing. Now, just to see the topologies of those three types of wave functions, here is Hartree-Fock, and the amount of correlation energy which you get, these multiple Pfaffians, Ci, and here what I do is, this is for the oxygen atom, here is the nucleus, I fix the positions of the electrons, except two, and the two are sitting on the top of each other, it's like a singlet, and I scan now the wave function while everything else is static. So you see that you end up with this type of a two surfaces crossing each other, which is obvious coming from Hartree-Fock wave function. I mean, this will be spin up and this will be spin down. This is the same thing, just rotated. If you go to Pfaffian, you see there is a dramatic change. The pluses, which are really cut here into two pluses and two minuses, namely four cells, are actually connected with each other. Minuses are connected with each other. And the same is the case for a wave function, which we believe is very close to exact, which is the same topological property, but you see that the structure of the nodes is much finer here. Obviously, very high excitations are contributing. So it's not exactly the Pfaffians, is somewhere in between. Perhaps the last system which I want to show, where we started to work on this some time ago, is the unitary gas. Perhaps you have heard about this type of thing. So if you cool the atoms and you tune up the chemical potential through the Feshbach resonance by the magnetic field sufficiently carefully, you end up with a very interesting system, which is the following properties. The scattering length, okay, can be tuned in such a way that it's infinite, and then you end up with the limit which looks as follows: that the effective interaction between the atoms, which is actually attractive, the range of it is much smaller than is the mean distance between the particles, and this is much smaller than your scattering length, which is effectively infinite. You can actually really tune it to that regime. So what you end up is then, is that you have tuned the whole thing in such a way that there is the lowest bound state. You tune the energy exactly to the energy of that bond to be breaking. So, a very dynamical system, namely, particle flies, it is captured by the attractive potential of the other particle, but it can't stay in there because the energy is essentially zero, so it flies off. So dynamically forming and reforming pairs. This was an interesting case for QMC because you can easily show that you can write, or actually you can define, the total energy is some dimensionless parameter times the free energy of free fermions. What is interesting is that in these limits, essentially all the material constants go out. It looks like a mathematical model. There is essentially no scale. So you end up in something like a universal mathematical model for many body system. And this number looks something like a pi, you know, for a ratio of the square and a circle areas. So it was kind of interesting to calculate it, and some people did it early in 2003, Joe Carlson, Kevin Schmidt, and collaborators, and basically came up with this fixed node diffusion multicolor using BCS wave function, okay, to do so. And this was the thing, you know, the difference between the active fog is huge, actually. It looks more like almost 20%. So the pairing is very significant here. We started to work on this a little while ago. Basically, we were interested in the exact value of this parameter and using the techniques of the release node. And Joe has a number which he always writes unpublished, and now we have also an unpublished number, and they do agree very reasonably. Note that the correction from the BCS is still very significant, is about 10%. So the effects are huge, actually, here, unlike in electronic system where you are looking for the last few percent of the correlation energy. Why is this system interesting? Well, this system shows a big amount of condensate, actually, and you can directly calculate this here from a two-particle density matrix. And if you look at the whole thing, so this is the variation Monte Carlo, this is the diffusion Monte Carlo, they are both very similar. Roughly half of the particles is in the condensate. So unlike in the superconductivity, where the amount of particles in the condensate is just a tiny percentage of the particles around the Fermi surface, here it's a very robust condensate example. Half of them is in there. So the effects are huge. All is amplified very significantly. So it's a great system, actually, to study this. It is important, actually, that the nodal structure has an impact on the pairing in this system. So this is an example of the homogeneous electron gas. I have a bunch of particles in here, and I put here on this black dot with the number one, actually, is two particles, spin up and spin down. And you're trying to wind it around. What you end up is the following. If you have a Hartree Fock wave function, you will hit the nodes multiple times. Okay? If you correlate, you can always find a path where you can avoid the whole thing and you will not touch the node. This has to do something with the superconductivity in the following sense. Imagine that a superconducting pair would hit a node along the path. It means it will be zero. If it comes out at zero, its phase could be random. So you will lose a long-range coherence. So this is definitely a necessary condition for the superconductivity to occur. It doesn't tell you anything that it did because it requires a long-range correlations to work out. And this thing doesn't tell anything about it. Okay, maybe I'll skip this thing. Maybe I'll skip this thing too. This is kind of a dynamical simulation of how the nodes change. As you see, it's pretty complicated. And the last thing which I wanted to show was another type of a wave function, which is based on backflow. That's another way how to actually indirectly access the improvements of the nodes. And It's given, one can find it out in the following way. Imagine that you apply the Hamiltonian on this and you expand to the first order. If you rearrange the terms, you have one term here, which is essentially the thing coming from the electron-ion interaction, electron-electron part, and then you get something like a spurious term, which is actually a dot product of two, you can call them fluxes, okay? One is coming from the determinant part, the other is coming from the correlation. And now you have basically two limits. This flux is large, or the other flux is large. If this flux is much larger, means you have a very inhomogeneous system, and then essentially what is effective actually to cancel this term are those things which we have shown before. CI expansion, Pfaffian expansion, namely typical excitations, okay? If you have a homogeneous system, namely this is actually very small and this is significantly larger, then the backflow terms are effective, where the backflow is an effect if I'm moving the electron in here, what the other electrons are doing in a homogeneous system. They're trying to fill the hole behind it. So you get kind of a back current in there, and that can be done by these dressed coordinates, namely that the coordinate of the particle in my determinant or Pfaffian or any anti-symmetric form is dressed. So it's the usual form plus correction from the rest of the particles. It does something to the wave function. That something looks as follows. So the first example is actually carbon-2. So here we have three types of anti-symmetric wave function with various accuracy. So Slater, Hartree-Fock, Pfaffian, or CI. And now you plug in backflow, and you see the gain in here. But as you improve the wave function, the gain is getting smaller, and if you have something which is very accurate, the backflow goes away. Namely, the same effect actually simultaneously catched by this traditional improvement of this wave function when the system is actually strongly inhomogeneous, namely normal electronic system. In a homogeneous electron gas, this has been tried by a number of people, David did this in 92, you actually see a significant improvement. Roughly the fixed node error is cut by a factor of 2 or so, although here the differences look minor. If you actually look into the percentage, they are significant. It is still not exact, of course, but it's significantly better. Okay, I believe that I exhausted what I wanted to tell you. So, essentially, in a short summary, basically, we showed that hundreds of interacting quantum particles can be simulated at this point to a very significant level of accuracy. But I believe that this is more than that. I mean, we don't want to just to come up with the numbers, but you actually get unique insights into various aspects of the many-body effects. And you actually look at the problem from a completely different side from the traditional approaches. So I talked about the two-nodal cells for general fermionic states. And I claim that this is another example of importance of geometry for quantum monobody effects, although in condensed matter this is not very popular. I say this is not very popular yet. Okay? So, and you can try this by yourself if you want. The code which we use is in the open source domain. And note, I have made, how many systems did we do? Cluster, atoms, molecules, clusters, solids, and strongly correlated system, and the unitary gas. All were calculated with a single code. Okay? The same code was used for all these systems. So it tells you a little bit about the generality of the method. I think I should just thank you very much for coming.
Questions, comments?
Yeah. That statement about two nodal cells is completely general? Or, for example, if I take a Laughlin state in two dimensions,
Laughlin state
very far from simple.
Okay, Laughlin state is a complex wave function, okay? So you are coming into a higher dimension, so you talk about the phase and amplitude, or you talk about the real and imaginary part? And things are a lot more complicated there. The methodology can be extended in the sense of what the Herodot is did with Dave in 94 or so, that you define so-called fixed phase, which means that in some sense it's like the nodes would get spread it out all over the place. You get an effective field into your Hamiltonian, and you can prove that with that effective field coming from the phase, you get the best possible amplitude. And it's variational, okay? So in some sense, the node is just the collapsed phase into one dimension less. So it's kind of a special that it works. We actually use that property without me saying that, because for the solid calculations with the twist averaging, where you end up with the complex wave functions, and you do it. And what is interesting, there is no fundamental difference between the fixed node and a fixed phase. Basically, systematically, it behaves in a very similar way.
You mentioned that someone did the cold atoms and look at the superconductivity in those systems.
It's the system which has the condensate basically in the whole regime, but the condensate changes its character. Okay, on one side it is really like a very very weakly bounded, like a BCS type of a thing. On the other side, the atoms actually form bonds, and you get the molecules, and those molecules are bosons, and they fall into the usual bosonic condensate. And now in between there is this interesting unitary case. What is, however, very interesting, the same wave function describes the whole regime. Same type of the wave function describes the whole regime.
Well, so the question I had is, it's if anyone looked at the spins in two-dimensional lattice to study the wave superconductivity, like a kinesis, with this method.
I mean, there's the whole industry of Hubbard model, right? So which use QMC version for the lattices.
Well, but those guys have problems with going to low temperatures, right?
Well, I have Sorella probably with this.
I mean, there is.
I mean, he would be the one that would have done it, I guess.
Yes. I think that Massimo Bonissani also did some work in that direction. I think that Shiwe also did early in the career some work in that direction.
Is there actually a case where the energy can be experimentally measured in the unitary loop?
Yes. And it has been measured.
Yes.
And it's roughly falling where it was calculated. Although you get a bunch of numbers within the thing depending on a group. The point is that usually they have a finite bulb. Well, here there are periodical boundary conditions. But people did also calculations for the finite bulb, you know, say confined in a harmonic or something, yeah. And you are getting roughly the same thing. This thing is very clean because it doesn't depend on any other parameter whatsoever. But once you put it into periodical boundary conditions, all the material parameters go away. So that's the appeal of the whole thing, to have one standard system to do the calculation there. But the energy is roughly falling where they actually see it, yes.
C20 at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Do the LDA results improve or depend a lot on how one does, how one includes van der Waals interactions there?
No, I don't think that van der Waals would. These are all strongly bonded systems, so I don't think that van der Waals is a point in there. But the bonding pattern is very different in those three systems. You know, if you take that cage, it's very compact with the multiple bonding. If you take that ring, there's a lot of low-lying excitations because it's kind of a conjugated. So you get a very dramatic changes in there, and DFP doesn't describe that very well.
More questions on this? Okay, so let's thank you for sharing.